You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, wages have been stagnating in the United States for decades. A new study says it might be because of a lack of business diversity, not enough employers in many communities and lines of work. We'll talk to a co-author of that study coming up. First, the fall midterm elections are 7 months away. In addition to voting for Congress, Wisconsin voters will cast ballots for governor, attorney general, the state legislature, and more. To get a sense of how Wisconsinites are feeling about the issues surrounding those races, the WPR News Department is kicking off a new project called Beyond the Ballot. In a nutshell, Wisconsin Public Radio is going around the state asking as many real people as possible the same set of election-related questions. The responses will then be used to help shape Wisconsin Public Radio's election coverage in the months to come. Bridget Bowden is a special projects reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. She oversees the Beyond the Ballot initiative. Bridget, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us more. I gave a real short version there. Tell us more about what you're going to be doing.
So Beyond the Ballot is an initiative that we, the news team, are taking on this year. We have a goal of talking to and interviewing 500 people across the state throughout the coming months. And we'll be asking everyone the exact same set of questions to try and get an idea of what's on their mind and what issues are important to them facing this fall's elections.
Why?
Because we think that people don't necessarily go to the polls just to vote for one particular candidate. They vote because they care about the things that affect their lives day to day. So we're trying to get beyond, the talking heads, what you hear on the news every day from candidates and from people who work for candidates, and really find out what the people, what's important to them and why they are motivated to go vote.
And we're talking about what we sometimes on our show, and you guys are using this phrase to call real people. And when we say that, we mean somebody who isn't the political scientist or reporter expert. We talk to them too. But what do you guys mean by real people in the news department?
Definitely. So we'll still be bringing you stories from those political scientists and the candidates and campaign staffers and that kind of thing. But we will also be bringing you stories from regular folks, your third grade teacher or the farmer that lives down the road, people that don't make it onto our airwaves very often, they still have really important things to say, and we want to give them an opportunity to speak to our audience.
And how are you going to go about selecting people from around the state to participate?
A couple of different ways. So all of our reporters will be going to events throughout the coming months. So big events, your summer festivals, farmers markets, that kind of thing. Anywhere where there might be a big group of people, we'll go and we'll bring our microphones and just ask people the questions, random people. We'll also be seeking out people deliberately, especially people who maybe aren't on our airwaves as often as they should be. So maybe younger people or people of color, people that we want to make sure to include in this project, we'll be seeking them out deliberately.
What I'm really interested in finding out is, we do call-ins, of course, but I think the more hot button a topic, the more likely that a very motivated person is going to call in, somebody who feels really strongly on one side or the other. So the sample may suggest that things are more divided and heated than maybe they actually are. So are you hoping to find out that sort of thing from people that maybe there are more people not on the ends of the spectrum?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we've done maybe 60 interviews so far, and I think that that has absolutely been the case. People are concerned about the things that affect their lives, but not everybody is, heated. Not everyone is, ready to attack the other side. People agree on a lot more than you think they would.
Talking to WPR reporter Bridget Bowden about a new project, the Beyond the Ballot Initiative, talking to people from around the state about what they think about politics and more. Bridget, you mentioned you had some interviews in the can already, and you've got a couple samples for us.
We do. So one of the things that people have brought up over and over again in the interviews that we've done so far is immigration. It's obviously a hot button issue right now. So lots of people have told us what they think about that issue. My first example is Anne Amani. She lives in Milwaukee, and she's originally from Kenya. She's a nurse practitioner, and she says she wants to see the public perception of immigrants get better than it currently is.
There are a lot of immigrants who work in healthcare, and as an immigrant and knowing how hard I work and also how much it's taking me to get my citizenship or waiting for it, I feel like all Americans should know what it takes and how much vetting is done in order to get your citizenship, so that we should not assume that immigrants are these bad people. This country is built on immigrants, and we are glad to really participate and do what it takes to build a great nation.
And so a lot of people have shared their thoughts on this issue, and people don't always agree, and different people see different sides of each issue. So my second clip is Dawn McCullough, who is a registered nurse, and she thinks there are some issues with our immigration system as it currently is.
I think that immigration should be something that is a process where people apply for it, and then accepting people that have crossed into this country illegally is actually disenfranchising those that follow an established process to become a citizen. So I think that immigration needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed on the national level, and then it should filter down to the state level.
As you're talking to people, you're not volunteering issues for them, right?
Right. The questions are very open-ended. They're things like, what's the single most important issue to you and why? Another example would be, what's going on in your community that nobody's talking about? So we're trying to give people the opportunity to tell us what's important to them. I feel like a lot of times we as reporters cover what issues we think are important, and maybe we should be spending a little more time asking the public what's important to them.
Yeah, and we've used survey data to kind of guide our coverage sometimes in the news department and on the Ideas Network. We've asked people what's the most important issue, and we'll get broad categories like the economy or taxes or crime or something. What's it like to hear, you know, exactly what people are looking for in those topics?
Yeah, I mean, often when you ask that question, what's the most important thing to you, people will give you a one-word answer. The advantage to going out and doing these interviews in person is that then we can say, well, why? How does that impact you? What do you mean? How does that affect your life? By actually being there with these people, we have the opportunity to dig into the issues a little more deeply.
You said you're looking to get 500 interviews as you go on through this process. And then what? What do you do with all this stuff?
So we'll have stories on our newscasts and on our talk shows, just like you would regularly hear on Wisconsin Public Radio. And then you'll also be able to find the stories online. And the website is wpr.org/ballot. So all the stories will be there, and also photos of everyone we're interviewing. So you can kind of scroll through and see what the people of Wisconsin are saying.
And is there a hope for kind of a second tier of this then? Wow, we keep hearing subject X from people, and that's something we haven't covered much. Is that going to hopefully or potentially drive coverage maybe at the local level or the state level in the future?
Absolutely. I hope that happens. I hope that the people that we talk to tell us things that we didn't know were going on, and then we can go and run with it from there and bring you stories based on those things.
And we're just getting a taste of it right now. When are we going to start hearing these stories?
So you'll be hearing the stories starting this week. We have our first feature story airing this Thursday. It's about water quality. A lot of people are concerned about the water quality in their well water. But then throughout the coming months, these stories will roll out as we talk to people and as we find out what's important to them.
And if people are listening and thinking, yeah, I'd like to talk to you, can they reach out to you?
Absolutely. We have a hotline that people can call and leave us a message that we might be able to use on the air. So that number is 877-782-8942. And we also have an email address, which is beyondtheballot@wpr.org, where you can send us a note.
So I look forward to hearing the features and talking to you more about this as the project goes on. And you're going to keep doing this through Election Day?
At least through Election Day, and maybe from there on.
Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Bridget Bowden, Special Projects Reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. She talked to us about the new Beyond the Ballot initiative, which debuts this week. First, over the last four decades or so in the United States, wages have been largely stagnant. According to a report last year from the Brookings Institution and the Hamilton Project, wages between 1973 and 2017 only rose about 10% when you adjust for inflation. Economists have tried to find the culprit behind these sluggish wages. Possible causes include the decline of organized labor, automation of workplaces, and outsourcing of jobs. New research from labor economists found that the issue could have more to do with a shrinking number of employers in many communities and job fields and the bargaining power that gives to those employers. Ioana Marinescu is an economist and assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. She's a co-author of that study. Ioana, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about this study from you and your colleagues. What did you set out to try to find out?
So look, the idea is this, you know, we all know that wages tend to be higher when the economy is doing well and there's plenty of jobs around. And that story we all know about, but we're adding a new twist to it, which is, you know, maybe there's a lot of jobs, but suppose that all retail jobs are always Amazon. Well, it's great that there's a lot of jobs, you know, but if they're always Amazon, Amazon is not going to compete with itself and raise wages to go after workers. And so the basic idea we're looking at is whether when there are fewer employers, even for the given number of jobs, wages are lower. And in fact, that's exactly what we find.
Yeah, this introduced a concept to me. We've all probably heard of monopoly, you know, the idea of a business dominating a consumer market, say, or the board game for that matter. There's this thing called monopsony that is what you're talking about. What does monopsony mean?
That's exactly right. So this is a term coined by female economist Joan Robinson in the 30s, and it means that there's only one employer in town or in a given field. And so, you know, the classic example is a company town with a mine. But nowadays, for example, hypothetically, imagine Amazon were the only retailer, then Amazon would have a monopsony for retail workers. So that's what monopsony means, if you're the only employer for a certain type of work in a certain area.
So in this study, you set out and you looked at pretty much the whole country, and you took data, I think, from online job postings and things like that, and tried to figure out how concentrated different communities were, right? First, how did you try to sort this out?
So, you know, we were so lucky to be able to work with such an amazing trove of data from Burning Glass Technologies. This company collects data on online job postings, and so we were able to look across the whole country in all different kinds of jobs. And what we found was pretty astounding, which is that on average, a community in the U.S. only has about 2.5 employers for a specific type of job, which is, would be something like a customer service representative, for example. So, you know, on average across the country, only 2.5 employers are vying for workers in a particular, again, occupation and place. So that's really little. Now, importantly, you know, let's be clear, it's much worse in smaller places. In very big cities like New York, it's mostly not a problem. But in many, many, many places across the country, there are very few employers. And in fact, we found that, you know, there's a term that is legal. You know, they have a threshold for high concentration, meaning that there's really little competition. And we found that more than half of the labor market in the countries are highly concentrated.
And looking at a map, you mentioned bigger cities, maybe this isn't such a problem. There's a bigger diversity of employers. But if I look at northern Wisconsin, there are fewer options of employment, a lot of smaller communities. So if you're in healthcare and there's only one, you know, hospital healthcare network, you have exactly one job choice. Is that the sort of thing you're finding?
That's exactly right. And we showed that this situation is extremely common in the country. And again, it's more than half of the markets that are highly concentrated, meaning that there are very few employers in that specific market.
And so talk about how that then can drive lower wages or stagnant wages.
Exactly. So let's talk about that. So, you know, what you have to think about in your head is that, well, if I'm the only employer out here, well, then, you know, basically workers have to work for me or either not work or go work in another job that is less fit for their skills, where they're likely going to get paid less. And so I'm going to take advantage of my position as the sole employer, or, you know, one of a few, to pay workers less. And even if I'm not the only one, let's say we're two of them, you know, there are lots of reasons why the two employers are maybe not the same. Maybe, for example, one of the two is closer to home for some workers. So the employer, given that workers don't have many opportunities, can more easily pay the worker less, again, in order to take advantage of the fact that they don't need to compete with other employers to attract workers. And the more employers are out there, different kinds of employers out there competing for workers, and you see it's kind of like a bidding war, right? Like they'll say, hey, I'll pay you this much. And then the neighboring employer will say, well, come to me, I'll pay you more. It's kind of, you have to imagine it's the same situation that you're having in a market where you're trying to buy some goods and all the sellers are shouting, my good is cheaper, my good is cheaper. Well, for the labor market, it's a little bit similar, but it's the opposite. You know, if there's lots of employers, everyone's going to be shouting, come at my place, I pay more, right? And if there's not many of them, oh, no, then they can sit down and relax and pay less, right?
Ioana Marinescu is with us from the University of Pennsylvania. She's the co-author of a study on stagnant wages in the United States. In the study, they find that a lack of competition among employers in many places and many lines of work may be a big factor in keeping wages down in the United States. And Ioana, outside of the study, you've also talked elsewhere about something that might add to the problem. Businesses having non-compete clauses, saying if you're my employee and you want to leave, you can't go and work for a competitor. Also, non-poaching agreements. So if I have a franchise of a fast food restaurant and somebody else has one across town, we might have an agreement not to compete with each other for the same employees. Does this add to this monopsony problem, this lack of competition among employers?
Absolutely, it does. And actually, this is very important for policy in terms of, you know, legal enforcement. So I want to just get this straight for our listeners that, you know, in this country, when two companies want to merge, they go for an antitrust review, or they might go for antitrust review, and then the Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice might say, no, you can't merge because you're going to create monopoly power in the market. And so this, we are saying, is going to, you know, potentially create problems in the labor market. And where does this anti-poaching agreement, for example, come in? Well, if two employers, like, you know, there was a famous case for software engineers where Google and Apple agreed not to hire each other's engineers. Well, if you and I have a no-poaching agreement, and then we merge, well, even without merging, we're already colluding and trying to keep down wages and prevent, you know, competition for employees. If we merge, well, that'd be even easier. We don't even need a no-poaching agreement. We're the same company. Yoo-hoo! So, basically, no-poaching agreements reduce competition even more, and the fact that two companies engaged in a no-poaching agreement is already good evidence to say that these companies shouldn't be merging, because allowing them to merge will radically decrease competition for workers in the labor market.
Do you see policy solutions to, let's start with these no-poaching agreements and non-compete clauses. Are there people trying to pass laws to make these harder to enforce?
So no-poaching agreements are illegal. That doesn't mean employers don't try, but they are illegal, and when they are discovered, employers get sued for them. Non-compete clauses are legal, but there are some restrictions, and, you know, right now there's a rethinking about how, you know, restricted this should be, and in particular that it should be clearer that this is only allowable for highly skilled workers who, in fact, you know, might reveal some trade secrets, and therefore it might make sense to have a non-compete clause. But, you know, there's been non-compete clauses for sandwich makers at Jimmy John's, and it seems that in that case there isn't really any trade secret that is trying to be protected here, but instead it's a ploy for employers to dissuade workers from looking for other better paying jobs elsewhere. And so that's where we need a clearer, you know, boundary of enforcement in terms of non-compete. What is a legitimate non-compete and what is not a legitimate non-compete? And there's action right now in terms of trying to think about how to redefine what a legitimate non-compete is. And it's also different in different states. So we can learn also a lot from looking at the variation across different U.S. states.
And then with the wider issue that was the focus of your study, I mean, it seems like the tendency is we're going to have companies merging into bigger companies or big companies driving smaller companies out of business. Is this trend to fewer employers who have more bargaining power over their employees, is anything going to change that?
So, you know, it's obviously you're fighting against the tide because there's been a huge rise in mergers and acquisitions in the past 20, 30 years, and this has been accompanied by a huge rise in profits. And we're thinking that this probably contributed right to the stagnation of wages. What can we do? Well, one simple thing we can do right now is to start enforcing antitrust when it comes to labor market competition. I wrote a law review paper with my law professor colleague, Herb Hovenkamp, who's also at the University of Pennsylvania, and we argued that regulators have all the tools in their toolkits to stop mergers that will create anti-competitive effects in the labor market. And in our paper, we lay out exactly how they are going to do that. And so we're very much hoping that, judges and regulators will take this on and will see cases of companies whose mergers are stopped because it is clear that this is going to create anti-competitive effects in the labor market. So that's a start, but that's something that can be done immediately. It's just a matter of the regulators and the judges availing themselves of a legal framework that essentially is already there. And we just need to pay attention to this issue. And it's pretty straightforward. There isn't much at all that needs to change.
Joanna, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be there.
Joanna Marinescu is an economist and an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. She joined us to talk about research. She's co-authored Looking at Competition in Job Markets and Why Wage Growth Has Been Slow in Recent Years. Her colleagues make the case that in many places, in many job sectors, there are too few employers giving them more bargaining power. That's keeping wages, they say, down around the country. Now, there's been a lot of news about election security since the last presidential election, from conflicting reports about attempted Russian hacking into state websites and the state's voter registration system to recent news that an unknown number of Milwaukee voters and some others around the state may have been kicked off the voter rolls incorrectly. With our next statewide election set for tomorrow, we wanted to hear from the people overseeing the election in their towns and counties. Barbara Geckner is the president of the Wisconsin Municipal Clerks Association. She talked to some clerks around the state about how they're feeling pre-election day. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when you've talked to clerks around the state, what are members of your organization saying about the security of our local voting systems?
We all have a great deal of confidence in our voting systems. Our voting equipment is top-notch in Wisconsin. We've done very well with proving out, especially with the presidential recount, how well our equipment runs and functions. And I have, and other clerks do not have any concerns whatsoever about the security of our equipment.
Now, we've heard at the statewide level and at the national level these concerns about Russian interference and trying to get into states' election systems, and the story bounced around a lot. It turns out that the state's election systems were never gotten into by anyone. Is there worry about what's happening outside of the country, beyond the borders, where local clerks may not have a lot of influence?
I don't believe so. Again, we have full confidence in the Wisconsin Election Commission, its associated agencies, and the staff to maintain our election systems and the information in the safest and most secure manner. The fact that they did not get in and were not able to hack into the system speaks for how well the system is taken care of, and I believe that the state has taken every precaution to make sure that that does not happen. We at the local level, of course, have our own information systems in place as far as firewalls and security and such, and I don't have any concerns in that manner either. I believe that with everything the WEC does for us and make sure that all the securities are in place, that we won't have any issues whatsoever.
And then on another issue, a couple of clerks and the mayor of Milwaukee actually raised concerns about people being removed from voter rolls by the statewide ERIC system. Have you heard worries about that from clerks around the state?
I have not. I talked to a number of different clerks just in the past few days, and from smaller communities to medium to large communities, and while some of them may have some very large supplemental lists, the state prepared the supplemental poll list for those who were removed through the ERIC postcard system. So we have that to go to at the elections tomorrow. In case somebody says they were removed, they don't know why, they'll still be able to vote and sign up through that process. In my experience, we send out the postcards every time, or the state sends them out for us every time somebody registers, And if those come back to us as clerks, we try to follow up right away and make sure if there's any issue whatsoever and get that taken care of. And even when people do vote and register on election day, there's sometimes follow-up letters that are required to go out because information might be missing. And in my experience, we either don't get those ERIC postcards back to us or the other postcards, and we also don't get responses sometimes for those follow-up letters. And when people will come to the polls and say, well, I just registered at the last election or I voted in the last election, in my experience at times their last election to them was the last presidential, which occurs once every 4 years. And or people sometimes get confused as to which location they voted at. They may have registered in a location that was not accurate, and then they would get inactivated at the local level at the clerk's office. And again, a follow-up letter would be sent to them. So I don't really have any concerns, and the clerks that I spoke with don't have any extenuating concerns. I do know that there are some county clerks and others who have expressed concerns about the process and needing to find out maybe why some of these occurred. I will say there was one small community that I spoke with earlier, and they did say on their list of about 40 people, they had two people on there that had not moved or changed, and so should not have been on that supplemental list, and they're still working to figure out what happened there. One of those cases was someone who lived in an apartment building, and we do experience here and there, especially the bigger the municipality and the more transient locations they have within their municipality. People who live in apartment buildings may just move to another apartment and they don't think they need to register. However, they do need to re-register because their location and address has changed.
You mentioned that supplemental voting option that will be at all polling sites. If someone is voting tomorrow and they do that, what are they going to have to do?
They're just, the supplemental poll list is just like the regular poll list, although it is says basically that, you know, they were removed from the list. They just sign it like they would the regular poll list. They sign in so that they can just go ahead and vote that same day. So they won't have any problems if they're on that supplemental list, if for whatever reason they were removed from the regular list. They'll just be able to sign in and vote.
For people thinking of voting tomorrow, especially people who've maybe moved in the last year or two, say, or haven't voted in a while, can you give them some homework to make sure their voting goes as smoothly as possible tomorrow?
Well, be sure they have their proper photo ID with them, nothing that is expired. And it never hurts, you know, if your photo ID is also has your current address, you should be all set. If for any reason whatsoever you do need to register where you're at, you want to be sure that you have the proper proof of residence. If you don't have a current address on your driver's license or other thing, you need to bring a utility bill or bank statement or something of the such so that you can register right on the spot without any problem. We do hate to see anybody have to go home and get additional information to come back for that. But if you have your proper photo ID, you should be all set.
Well, Barbara, thanks for joining us. I'm sure it's a busy day for you tomorrow. Thanks for taking the time.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Barbara Gechner, the president of the Wisconsin Municipal Clerks Association. Erin Grunze joins us now. She is the executive director of the League of Women Voters in Wisconsin. She's with us to recap what's been going on in Wisconsin election news since the 2016 presidential election. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, with election day tomorrow, what are you and the League of Women Voters watching for?
So tomorrow we will be once again having our observers in the polls. For many of the larger turnout elections, we put observers in the polls to watch for some of the things that that was just described by the last guest in terms of the supplemental list and how easy it is for people to receive their ballot if they need to do same day voter registration. And then if they are unable to vote, are they being helped and told what they need to do in order so they could still possibly vote that day or be prepared for the next election? So we've been preparing that program. We have about 100 volunteers who will be in about 150-170 municipality locations, including rural, suburban, and urban polling sites, and we compile a report from the observers notes that they take.
I want to dig into that supplemental list and worries about this system, Eric, the interstate system Wisconsin uses to maintain accurate voter rolls. Here's Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett talking to us last week after reports that the system had incorrectly kicked some Milwaukeeans off of voter rolls.
I am claiming it's not ready for prime time, that until the state can satisfy us that people are not going to be denied the right to vote, I'm saying, well, let's delay implementation of that for this year, and let's make sure we get it done right.
So is this system ready for prime time, in your view, Aaron?
Well, there were some problems. That's undeniable. We would have liked the Wisconsin Election Commission to have just put everybody back on and had one list to look at instead of a supplemental list. We feel that this is a temporary fix and that we would like to see a long-term solution be put into place. I think that the system needs the rollout is done, but it needs some better management so that these errors aren't happening. We've been trying to spread the word, though we're just, one organization and some of our partners as well, that people should be trying to look up their status before they go to the polls to make sure they didn't have any problems. But that supplemental list, we'll be watching to see how that's implemented and how that goes. We imagine this problem to increase as the voter turnout increases throughout this year.
Aaron Grunzi is with us from the League of Women Voters Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or concerns about how we vote in Wisconsin on the eve of a statewide election? Are you worried about the security of voting after news of Russian hacking attempts in the United States, targeting not apparently voter rolls here in the state, but other state websites? Did you have to re-register on voting day last month? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Aaron Grunzi, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters Wisconsin. She's with us to review some of the latest in election news, election security, and voting issues in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about voting, how we do it in the state, voting security, making sure your vote is accepted and counted? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aaron, wanted to ask you about election security. We heard from the Municipal Clerks organization that they feel pretty secure about efforts to tamper with any part of the state's election system. Do you think the state's done enough when it comes to voter security?
Well, I think there's always more to be done, and my understanding is that we were just granted some federal election security funding for the state to put towards election security, so that's good. There's always machines that can be updated and better watch of our system. I think the fact that we have a decentralized system bodes well for Wisconsin. I think it's hard to really be disruptive to the entire state because of this decentralized system. I also think that the fact that we have paper ballots bodes well for Wisconsin as well. There's always that paper trail that we can go back to review the election results.
And I wanted to ask, a big story in elections is a change in the leadership of the state's Elections Commission. Mike Haas, the commission's previous administrator, announced his resignation. The Senate had unconfirmed him, basically. Can you talk about that issue and how it could affect elections in the state?
Sure. So I think it's very disappointing that Mike Haas had to leave his role. He was an excellent public servant. He was very welcoming of the league's comments and communicated with us very well. Even in times when we were critical, we sued them over the implementation of the photo ID law, and we still maintained a very professional and workable relationship. I think he was unfairly targeted. He was removed from his position for non-performance reasons, and I think overall it'll be a loss for Wisconsin. That said, Megan Wolf will now step into that position as lead administrator. She has worked for the commission for a number of years, and I think that she'll do a very good job. Her supporting staff is also very well-versed in all of their roles. So I have confidence that they will continue operating as they have. They unfortunately are also understaffed, and that's been something that we have been fighting for them as well, is that they should be fully staffed so that they can attend to these issues to safeguard our elections and keep the security elements in good working order.
Weird from Willem and Colfax, who just wants to clarify, and this has been a confusing issue over the years, what kinds of IDs can voters use at the polls?
Yeah, so this is confusing. At the polls, most voters will have a state license or ID that they can use. And then there are a handful of other IDs that people can use, such as a veteran's ID card, a passport also works. There is if they're a university or college student or tech student, they can use their student ID, but it has to be one that meets all the requirements, and they should check with their university on if theirs does or if they need to obtain a second ID. They also need proof of enrollment if they're a student. Things like a driver's license receipt also works. So if you've been issued that in the last week and you haven't yet received your state license, you can use your receipt to vote. Also a tribal ID card, a certificate of naturalization. Those are the types of IDs that will work at the polls to prove your identity.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Aaron, what is your biggest concern when it comes to voting access here in Wisconsin?
Voting access, I guess our biggest concern at the league is that the access is equal. When access isn't equal, then, to things like photo IDs or the types of documents needed to prove residency, when those things aren't equal, then access to the ballot isn't equal. And I think that's our biggest concern, is that we help everybody that we can to obtain those things. But we also, want to point out to the lawmakers that these laws aren't maybe doing what you thought they would, and they're preventing people who would otherwise be able to vote from not voting. And it's disproportionately affecting students, lower income individuals, seniors, and we hear this each and every election. And so that's I think the biggest issue with access, is when the access to the items that are needed to vote aren't equal, then access to the ballot isn't equal.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Aaron Grunze. She's the executive director of the League of Women Voters in Wisconsin. She was with us to talk about election security and voting issues before the state goes to the polls tomorrow. Tomorrow is Election Day, and among other issues, voters are headed to the polls to choose Wisconsin's next Supreme Court justice in a race between judges Rebecca Dallet and Michael Skrenek. The campaign has been more overtly partisan than any in recent memory in what's officially a nonpartisan race. As Sean Johnson reports, it reflects an evolution of judicial campaigns that began in many ways with another Supreme Court contest a decade ago.
In 2008, former state Supreme Court Justice Lewis Butler was the candidate favored by Democrats. He was running during a two-year Democratic wave, and an incumbent justice had not lost in Wisconsin in more than 40 years. And yet Butler was defeated that year by now Justice Michael Gableman, providing the template for how to win and lose Supreme Court races in Wisconsin. University of Wisconsin-Madison politics and law professor Howard Schwaber says the race was transformative.
2008 marks the beginning of the conversion of Wisconsin judicial politics to just an extension of partisan politics by other means.
Schwaber says Butler was old school In this 2008 debate with Gabelman, Butler avoided saying political things.
I think it is inappropriate for a judge or a justice to tell you that I'm a conservative or a liberal, or if you, or I'm a candidate of big business or law enforcement or labor or whoever, because it's, you're trying to send the signal that if you vote with me, I'll vote with you. And that's not what the justice system is all about.
Gabelman was more willing to label himself and label Butler repeatedly.
I am a judicial conservative. My opponent has been legislating from the bench. Choice between me, a judicial conservative, and my opponent, a judicial activist.
I am a judicial conservative who gives a fair application to the plain language of the law, and my opponent has been acting as a judicial activist.
Gabelman's victory flipped control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Schwaber says other conservatives used a similar formula. Today, they hold a 5-2 majority.
In the Gabelman cycle and for several cycles thereafter, the Democrats were very, very slow to catch on.
Gabelman is not running for re-election this year, but the conservative candidate, Sauk County Judge Michael Skranok, is hitting similar notes.
To put it simply, the role of a judge is to be an arbiter of the law, not a policy analyst or a political activist. You know the dangers of a court legislating from the bench.
This time, the liberal candidate, Milwaukee County Judge Rebecca Dallet, is finding new ways to hit back.
He would be a rubber stamp to the interests of the governor, the interests of the Republican Party, and the interests of the people. We have to have a court that we have confidence in that's going to be making the decisions and not being a rubber stamp to the governor or to the executive. And further politicize the judiciary as Scott Walker's rubber stamp.
Dallet has also been willing to identify with Democrats, speaking at their state convention, marching for gun control, and receiving endorsements from big names like former Vice President Joe Biden. At a San Francisco fundraiser, she told the audience that their values were Wisconsin values that had been lost along the way. Skranok has seized on that.
Well, as I've been traveling the state since then, people have come up to me and said, San Francisco values are not my values.
But Skranok's campaign has also evolved. The state's business lobby is running ads on his behalf, as it did for Gabelman. But Skranok has also received more than $300,000 from the Republican Party, which is a first in Wisconsin's officially nonpartisan judicial elections. Dallet says that means he can't be independent.
People don't just give money away. They have an expectation. And I think the viewers all understand that. I think the people in our state understand that. That there is some investment that these groups are making in you in order to get you on the court so that you'll do their bidding.
A decade ago, Gabelman defeated Butler by just 22,000 votes statewide. He went on to write landmark opinions that upheld Governor Walker's Act 10 and that shut down an investigation into Walker's campaign. Whoever wins tomorrow's election will have the opportunity to serve until at least 2028, giving them the chance to write the landmark rulings of the next decade. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That election is tomorrow, and you can hear Sean Johnson checking in on the results tomorrow evening here on the Ideas Network.